This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Welcome to Season 5's wrap-up episode of What I Did Next from A&T Media. I'm Malak Fouad. We've had some amazing guests this season. We welcomed actor-comedian Rami Youssef, journalist Hela Gorani, entrepreneur and political commentator Ali Shehebi, luxury designers Munez and A. Abdelraouf, Meta's Faris Hakked, as well as writer and radio broadcaster Selma Al-Wardani, chef Hussein Hadid, and architect Omneya Abdelbar. Our wrap-up episode has traditionally become a place for a look back at the season's highlights, as well as a look forward to what's to come next season. This episode covers that, but we also go into a bit more detail about my own life and my own twists and turns. Chirag Desai, the show's producer, is asking the questions today.
So actually, I want to take us back to like this conversation we were having a couple of days ago, where I just very casually mentioned that episode 50 is coming up. And it kind of caught you by surprise. So that's my way of saying welcome to like the season wrap up.
Yeah. Hi, Chirag. I cannot believe we're at the end of season 5. Really, it's quite unbelievable.
I know.
But it took me completely by surprise when you said that, because I guess partly because we do this in like increments of 8 episodes at a time. And it's 2 seasons a year.
Yeah.
And the number just floored me when you told me 50 episodes. I couldn't believe it.
You know, the way you put it just now sounded almost like, yeah, you know, we're doing 2 seasons. But actually, it's like, no, we're doing 2 seasons a year, right? We've got that consistency out the door. Yeah. We're already working on the next season. So it's also a testament to all of that coming together, which I think is important to remember and celebrate.
I agree. I mean, I think consistency is the key across everything. And that's kind of been my mantra the last few months on across different parts of my life.
So as we tend to do, I mean, at the end of the season, we sit down, we kind of recap a little bit of the season. We look at some commonalities and some interesting things that have come out of it. This time around, I feel like, you know, not that there weren't other themes, there were, but I think there was one kind of theme that kind of hit almost everybody. And it was so prominent that you started calling it out in your interviews just organically. And just to sort of put that for context, is it's the concept of identity. And that identity, of course, comes in different formats also. So, you know, there is the discovery of identity. There is sort of the exploration, exhibition of identity or celebration of it. So you think of someone like Rami, right, where he's using it as a way to express his show. It's using, you know, all of that, or Omneya, for example. But then you look at also the sort of the debate of identity. Let's you look at someone like Selma, who spent a lot of her life trying to connect with it and trying to find it. And then you have someone at the other end, like a Faris, who, because of his exposure to so many different cultures and stuff, is actually very settled in his identity.
So tell me, Faris, we've had a lot of guests recently who have really been questioning a lot where they're from. What does it mean to be from somewhere when you've lived in so many different places around the world? So it's interesting that you have that foundation is still very strong in you.
It's a defense mechanism.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Absolutely. I think if you don't recognize and own who you are, then you're exposed to people telling you who you are. And that's a very dangerous thing.
I think that this issue is very much a generational issue. So, you know, Selma Al-Wardani and Rami, I think, are similar in age. Mm-hmm. And they interpreted identity through the prism of religion. Mm-hmm. Hela and Faris and myself, I'll put myself in that category as well,
being a bit older, I think we see it much more in the prism of where we're from, what country we're from, what is our ethnic background, if you like, for a better word. And so I think these are questions that are really important, and I think they're important regardless of your age. So, you know, we spoke about the intergenerational thing, but the questions of identity, you know, we carry that with us throughout our lives. And, you know, the first question any new person will ask you is, where are you from? Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, you have to come to terms with that answer. You know, what do you say?
Since you mentioned you, and I think that was something I wanted to also talk about in terms of how you feel about your identity, right? Because you were someone who, as you said, lived abroad for a lot of your life and sort of found this pull, as we've discussed before, to Cairo. And I remember you told us last time that when you came, as in this last sort of iteration of you coming, because I know you came and went in between, you were just like, I'm just not even going to look at that return flight. So how do you today, perhaps, and especially with now that you've had all these conversations, like, how do you feel about your identity?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword, I think, for me. And I think it's still a kind of a contradiction, or it's still a bit in flux. So there are moments when I feel very Egyptian, and there are moments when I feel very foreign. As you remember from our first conversation, and we'd had this conversation in our wrap-up episode in season one, mm-hmm. which is now going back a long way.
Yes, it was almost 50 episodes ago.
Yes, exactly. I'm fully Egyptian, but I was born and raised outside of Egypt, and I moved to Egypt at the age of 28. So I was a fully formed human being by then, right. And I was born in America, and then spent my young formative years in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah, and then from there I moved to the UK to boarding school at the age of 12, and stayed on for all of my teens and 20s, and then I came back to Egypt on after university for a year. But didn't find myself happy to be living in Egypt. I found it a very difficult place to live at the time. You know, having said that, Egypt has always been in my blood on every level. I would come back for holidays all my life. I have a huge extended family that are very important to me. And as an only child, that connection was really, really important. You know, that when I moved here 20 years ago, settling down here was very, very easy on that level. You know, I had a network already established. Right. And so I didn't feel like a fish out of water to a large extent. But on a larger level, I think my way of thinking is still very foreign. It's very hard to be to think differently to the place you're living in, because there are lots of frustrations that come with that. But at the same mm-hmm. time, you bring a know-how in a certain way that is advantageous. But I think on some level, I found that the experience of being abroad all my life, I think subconsciously, I didn't want that for my children.
Okay.
I'm very happy that my children don't have that same sort of nomadic, if you like, for want of a better word, nomadic upbringing that I had, in a way, because having that grounding and being sure of where you're from and who you are and being in one place for the entire, you know, period of your childhood, I think is priceless. And I think it gives you a very strong sense of self. And I think it allows you to be very confident in who you are. And that was something that, you know, my husband and I were able to provide our children. And you know, as time has gone by, I've found that to be a real advantage and a real privilege for them. You know, they are exposed, obviously, to, you know, different parts of the world. But having that sense of truly being from one place, I think for them is a very good thing. And it's something I'm very happy that they have.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. So, you know, for me, like, just for context, like, I come at this from the kind of the opposite way. I'm Indian in terms of origin, but I grew up here.
In Dubai.
Yeah, in Dubai. So I didn't have that sort of question mark almost. So when I went to the US, for example, and that's like the easiest example I can give you, if someone asked me where I was from, I would always say Dubai. I almost never said India. Because I didn't have, we went a lot, right, by the way. So we used to go during the summer vacations and all that. We visited a lot, but I never felt at home there, actually. And this is true among so many of my friends. And I don't mean just Indian friends, right? Any expat friends, people who grew up in this region, who always feel this is home.
Mm.
My center was here.
Yeah.
It still is, actually, in a lot of ways. The only difference is that, yeah, I've also sort of reconciled with my Indian identity and it's kind of become a part of me now a lot more strongly. But that happened in my adult life. It didn't happen in my childhood. So my childhood was very clear for me that the UAE was home. So what you described now about, you know, having spent some time there and didn't feel like a fish out of water, that happened to me only in the last sort of decade plus, where I started spending a lot more time there. That allowed me to get my own footing. So now I don't mind going there at all. And I find that as a contrast to some of my friends.
I also compare myself, for example, I have a lot of friends who are half this and half that and half Egyptian and half something else.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, they're kind of given a bit of a free pass because, you know, people who live in Egypt will say, oh, well, they're half this. So it's okay that they are a bit different. Whereas someone like me, who's fully Egyptian, I feel like I have more in common with them than I do with, you know, a lot of people who are fully Egyptian, because there is that other side, which maybe doesn't, you know, doesn't come out or doesn't appear, you know, visually, but is very much that other half of me, you know, and it can be challenging. It can be a little tricky to maneuver sometimes.
One of the things I think that's also come out in this season quite a bit is the impact of people around us. So maybe let's talk a little bit about that, right? Like in terms of the kind of impact that people around you had on you.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, you know, one huge influence in my life has been my aunt, my maternal aunt, my mother's sister, Nadia Yunus. We were extremely close. I even lived with her for a couple of summers when I was working at the United Nations in New York. Nadia passed away in 2003. She was one of the victims of one of the first bombings in Iraq post the invasion. She was a chief of staff to the head of the mission of the UN in Iraq. And she was one of 22, I believe, who passed away then. She was such a force of nature. Everyone who knew her remembers that about her. And she was a lifelong career diplomat at the UN. So she was the spokeswoman for the UN Secretary General in the early 90s, I believe he was there, Perez de Cuellar. And that was at the time of the first Gulf War. And so she was very, you know, constantly jetting into see Saddam Hussein with him and trying to persuade him that, you know, it's not a good idea to invade Kuwait and all of that stuff. It was, she's had a really varied career. And then she took a sabbatical and went to Kosovo and worked with Dr. Bernard Kouchner there, who was the ex-French foreign minister, who is also the founder of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. And she discovered an entire other side to herself, which was the idea of being in the field. She absolutely loved it. And she came to it very late in life. Most people who work at the UN do that first and then...
And then settle down.
Settle down to a career in headquarters. And she did the opposite. So she discovered this taste for the adventure and the idea of being in the midst of everything where things are really happening. I worked with her in the communications department and it was fascinating. And at the time, I wanted to follow her footsteps. I wanted to join the UN and be like my aunt. I mean, we all have those role models. And she very quickly said to me, don't do it. She said when she joined in the early 70s, it was idealistic. They all thought they were going to change the world, that, you know, peace was in their reach and all of that stuff. And she very quickly became disillusioned and said, listen, it's not a career for you. find something else to do. So I decided not to do that. But I went into something similar, which was journalism. So, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, I feel like you didn't take her advice all that seriously. You kind of took it. Okay, yeah, maybe not literally this, but I'm going to stay in this
exactly
area, which is interesting. Yeah.
But then the Iraq war was hotting up. And at the time, she was working at the WHO in Geneva. And she wanted to join the mission in Baghdad. And I'll never forget this. She came to Cairo in April 2003, and we were all here, the whole family was here, and we were begging her not to go, because we in the Middle East were already seeing the drum rolls of war that were starting, that America was pushing mm-hmm. for so much for it. And she went in June of 2003, and she lost her life in August. It was so beyond shocking to have been, to have been affected by such a violent death of a family member who was so close, that I don't think any of us have ever gotten over it. But her death did make us decide that it could not be in vain, and it could not be a wasted life. So we decided to raise money amongst family and friends to create a fund in her name that's been housed ever since at the American University in Cairo. And we've had this lecture series up until this year. So it's been about 18 years that we've been running it now. With the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, we've decided it's time now to move forward in a different capacity. And so now the fund is flipping into a scholarship. So there'll be now the Nadia Yunus Scholarship, also at AUC, and we'll be funding an undergraduate, partially funded, an undergraduate, an Egyptian young person to come to AUC and be able to study. And as you know, college fees around the world are so astronomical now that this kind of scholarship is very needy and very timely. So we're very proud of how the fund has evolved.
It also touches for me on this concept of like legacy, right? Because it's not something she created, right? It's not she created this lecture series or this fund and then you guys continued on, but this became the unifying moment for you to say, actually, here's how we want to maintain her legacy and then celebrate her legacy.
And I also think, you know, if you can pay it forward, I think you have a duty to do that. You know, I've been very lucky in my life. My family have been as well. And, you know, we feel that, you know, we come from a very, very poor country. And if we can help in any way, then it's our duty to do so. You know, I come from a political family, and we've always had that in us to give back in some way. So, and I think it's a fitting tribute to her, and I think it's very appropriate. We'll continue our conversation, including what's in my cultural inbox, right after this break.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back. I'm Malak Fouad, and you're listening to our season wrap-up episode where I'm being interviewed by my producer, Chirag Desai.
Let's continue the pivots. Let's talk about one of your... What was another pivot, perhaps, that has left and continues to leave an impression or an impact on you?
Yeah, so when I was 34, I'd just had given birth to my second child. And I was diagnosed with lymphoma, with cancer, 7 weeks after he was born. I can talk about it now with a lot of sort of hindsight and perspective and a sense of calmness. But, you know, at the time, it completely threw us all off. As you can imagine, in our entire concept of life got completely turned upside down.
Yeah.
As I said, I was only 34. Thank God my son was well. He was not impacted at all by it. But it completely stopped me in my tracks. I had been, working before that. I had, you know, was a very active mother. And it just completely stopped me. And it took me an extremely long time. Luckily, I got amazing medical treatment. I did 6 months of chemotherapy and was fine after that, physically fine. But of course, these things leave a scar emotionally, mentally.
And I think also in your case, I mean, it wasn't just about the shock of it, but you, like you said, you had just given birth to your son. And so you're sort of mentally preparing for this sort of recovery phase and this like joy and all of that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a total curveball, right? Like it's
absolutely
one of those things where they say like life throws something at you. It's literally that, right? It comes out completely out of the blue.
Yeah. It was just so shocking on so many levels. But, you know, like everything, when I feel that when you don't know you don't have fear, I feel, when you're doing something for the first time, and when it's so serious, you just get on with it and you just do it. And so those 6 months of treatment, I was juggling a toddler and a newborn, and I just went at it like a bull in a china shop. I didn't think. I just did what was asked of me. I was robotic about it. And I put all my emotions on a shelf, and I just ignored how I felt about everything. And it was only afterwards, when I started to settle into, you know, back to a normal kind of life, that I realized how emotionally exhausted I had been from it all. And it took a very long time to get over. And it's a very difficult thing for someone to deal with. And I think being so young as well, it's very shocking when someone that young experiences something like that. Because, you know, when you're in your mid-30s, you don't expect your life to suddenly literally stop.
It's massively impactful, yeah.
But you know what's interesting, Chirag, is I think that experience, and then on top of that, you know, much later, the experience of COVID and lockdown, and, you know, I, for one, I feel that, you know, life is short. Do what you want to do. Chase that dream. Do that, go for that, go after that job, buy that dress, take that trip. You know, I'm very much in that mindset right now where I don't want to put off anymore what I would have put off at another time of life, or had COVID not happened. And I think COVID has really been a big pivot point, not just for me, but I think for a lot of people. And it's a pivot point that we can all relate to. Whereas, you know, my cancer diagnosis was a very insular.
Yeah, personal, but it was personal to you and the people around you. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a private struggle with all these layers of things that I've been through. I have been afforded the ability to be much more empathetic with people.
Okay.
And much more able to see like a 360 of an issue. I feel like I'm able to put myself in people's shoes much more than I would have as a younger person.
Okay.
There's a sort of a communication opening there, I feel, that these experiences have given me.
Okay, so before we close out, and of course we have to do a little bit of housekeeping in terms of what's coming, but maybe let's talk first about your cultural inbox.
All right.
Oh, okay. You're pulling out notes. Cool.
I am. I have notes. So I am in the middle of a podcast from BBC Radio 4 called The Front Lines of Journalism. And it's by a very well-known foreign correspondent called Jeremy Bowen, who many people will know because he's covered the Middle East extensively. And I'm really enjoying the series. I'm sort of halfway through. And the reason I like it is because he's talking a lot about the ethical elements of journalism and fake news and how do you remain impartial? What's the difference between impartiality and objectivity? So these really sort of big kind of philosophical questions relating to the industry that I'm quite fascinated by. And so it's really interesting to hear his perspective. He's a very outspoken journalist and he doesn't remain quiet, which is very unusual about for a BBC reporter, who are always meant to sort of conform and toe the BBC line. And so, and he brings on really interesting guests as well to discuss it. So it's great. So I'm really enjoying that podcast at the moment.
I will definitely I'll definitely check it out. We'll also leave, we'll leave a link in the show notes because I think
that's... Yes, that's a good one to do that.
Here's a question. Do you think you would be a great guest for that show?
No, I don't think so because, I mean, I think what I do is too light for him. In another life, I would have chosen to be a foreign correspondent. I mean, I'm not going to kid you on that. That would have been my ultimate dream job. And when I was a fresh graduate, I actually applied for the BBC journalism training course. I didn't make the cut. Mm-hmm. And I think if I had been accepted, I would have been, in Ukraine right now. So that's another side of me that I, one of those sliding door moments, where one life would have led you somewhere and the other life led you somewhere else. So that would have been my sliding door moment.
Well, I'll just leave you by saying that this life led you to what I did next.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. What else?
So I'm going to share with you now my books. So I've just started literally last night a new book that I picked up at the local my favorite bookstore in Cairo, which is called Diwan, and it's called The Lost Manuscript. And I'm not going to talk about the book at all. I'm just going to read to you something at the very beginning, which basically sums up my attitude to books. So it says, to all the books we've read, to all those we have yet to read, because like sandmen, they sprinkle into our daily lives a few words or phrases that work their way into our subconscious over time and change us, discreetly but irrevocably. And I just thought that was just exactly my attitude to reading. And I want to share with you the actual book that I've just finished, and it's the third time I read it.
Okay.
I am not a self-help guru kind of person at all. I am a very much a fiction, literary kind of reader. But this book is just phenomenal. It's called Better Than Before. And she's an American writer, Gretchen Rubin. She wrote a book called The Happiness Project, which was really, I think it was her first bestseller. And this book is fantastic because I've been trying to create better habits for myself, and I've been trying to break bad habits and formulate a new way of living, a better lifestyle, a healthier lifestyle. And this book really helps put that into practice. It's helping me put things into practice that, on paper sound great, but then how do you actually do it? How do you get those that hour of exercise a day if that's what you want to do? Mm-hmm. How do you, lose those 5 extra kilos? How do you stop smoking if you're a smoker? Whatever it is you're trying to do, there are tools to do them with, and this book is what I'm using to help me do that. So there's my self-help guru. Piece of advice for you.
Not a turn I thought this podcast was ever going to take.
No, I know. It's not me at all, but it's a great book.
Fascinating. Well, that sort of brings us to the end of season 5 wrap up, man. It's funny, last season we were talking about how intense the season felt because we were kind of feeling like it was a bit last minute in terms of some of the things that had happened, just the way it panned out. Even though this season hasn't been that way, we've been a lot better planned. Things have been, there've been a lot of other things we've done as well. Of course, you were at the Egypt Fashion Week, and yet somehow it's flown by. It really has. Yeah. So obviously, it should come as no surprise that we'll be back again by September for season 6. So that's exciting. I think the other thing also I want to mention just really quickly is that if you're listening to this but you don't know, we do these bonus episodes now. We've been doing them for a couple of seasons, which is a member benefit, as we call it. So you can subscribe to that both on the website, but then also in Apple Podcasts, if that's your preferred player. And it's all the extra content, right? All these additional parts of the conversation that don't make it to the main episode or are just interesting tidbits and pieces. So we're going to keep doing that. I think it's interesting that there is this space that we can create where you can get to know our guests even more. That community is growing really fast, has grown really well this year for us so far. So we're quite happy about that too.
And we're going to be bringing you fresher takes as well. So we're changing things up a little bit in terms of the structure of the interviews. And we're also going to come up with we're also going to be bringing you a surprise. And so stay tuned for that. We'll be available on additional platforms as well. So that's an exciting stage for us.
And of course, as of today, you can already follow us on Instagram, on Twitter. You can sign up for email updates from our website, which I think is also, again, we've been kind of growing that community. As I mentioned already, you can subscribe for additional content, additional things. We'll keep sharing more things, of course, between now and by the time we're back for the next season. We'll look forward to each and every one of you joining us then.
Thanks, Chirag.
Yeah, that was fun.
Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back with new episodes in early September. Until then, you can catch up on our previous episodes and follow us for updates on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. See you soon!